Hello, podcast listeners. We know podcasts are a great way to catch up on a program that you may have missed on KSJE, and it's provided as a free service of this radio station. But, you know, KSJE is now listener-supported, and so while you enjoy this podcast, we hope that you'll also take some time to join KSJE. Become a member today. It's quite easy to do. Just go to our website at ksje.com/support and pick the level of support that best matches your budget. Thanks again for listening. Here's your podcast.
Hello, Yate, and welcome to Native Art Voices of the Four Corners. This is your host, Vinaya Yazi. Today, our guest is Cheryl Redhorse Bennett, and she is a writer and a native of the Four Corners. Good morning, Cheryl.
Good morning, Vinaya.
Yate, it's good to hear you again.
Yes, I'm happy to be here. I'm actually missing home right now, so it's good to hear about the Four Corners. I'm Cheryl Redhorse Bennett. I'm originally from Kirtland, New Mexico. My family currently lives in Shiprock, New Mexico. I spent most of my childhood in the Four Corners and am Diné and also Comanche. My dad was Comanche. I am a scholar of hate crimes and crimes committed against Native Americans and Indigenous people. Previously, I was an assistant professor at Arizona State University and Montana State University. I'm taking a bit of a hiatus right now, kind of studying law more these days.
That's a great turn. I think it's fitting to the process of what you're writing about and the subject matter. So law is very important, and I feel like we need more Native people involved in that area of study. Great to hear that, Cheryl. Like you said, you're missing the Four Corners right now here in the San Juan Valley. Our leaves are starting to turn, and then we got that chill in the morning, you know, and it's really nice to have that feeling again of renewal. Because as you know, Cheryl, as a Navajo person, this kind of begins our new season, right? Our new year is next month, beginning of autumn in October. And that's when we as Navajos celebrate a new beginning, as opposed to Americans celebrating the new year on January, where we are in it already in the beginning of the fall. With that, Cheryl, I'd like to have you introduce your book and tell us a little bit more about it, how you came to begin writing on this subject matter.
I think I thought about the issues of racism and discrimination from a very young age. I just couldn't put that to words when I was growing up in the Four Corners. I went to school at Kirtland Central High School, and there was a large population of Native students, but I think reflecting on that, there really was a lot of racism and discrimination there. And I knew something was wrong with the situation, and not just that, you know, at Kirtland, but interacting with Farmington as a border town, going shopping there with my parents or eating out. I felt stares from white people in Farmington and knew that it was wrong. But at the time growing up, I just couldn't put that to words. So I think later I moved away from the Four Corners. I went to Fort Lewis College, and then after that moved to Washington, D.C. for a little bit, and then spent some time in Los Angeles. And then when I returned home for a long period, and I talk about this in my book, my father was sick. He had a very traumatic brain injury. So I was at the hospital with my sister and my mom a lot. We were interacting with the staff at San Juan Regional, and they just treated us horribly. Being away for so long, I wasn't used to being treated so horribly. I was actually treated very respectfully in Los Angeles and other places. I wasn't followed around stores, shopping in urban centers where I kind of just blended in. You know, I was just another brown person in a big city. But going back to Farmington, it felt intensified, magnified. And I was talking to a good friend of mine, and she studies critical race theory. Her name's Angela, and she was studying law at UCLA. And I talked to her about what I was seeing in Farmington when my dad was sick. And at the time, too, I had just enrolled in a PhD program at the University of Arizona in American Indian Studies. And Angela was talking to me and telling me, well, you're telling me all these things about racism and discrimination in Farmington, and maybe have you ever thought about writing about it? And I think I had, but it was the first time that I talked to another person who actually thought it was a good idea. And so that was kind of the beginning of thinking about writing about Farmington as a topic. And as a, it being the place where I was from, it felt that it was something I needed to do.
I feel like our experience parallels one another. You know, like you, I went away to college and lived in an urban space, and then I came back. You know, it's just something that I didn't realize that I was amidst of until I went away and came back. And then I, just like you, I was like, why are people treating me like this? I lived in different places and no one ever really treated me bad because I was a person of color, Native American. And then, you know, I guess with you, you know, you decided to become more proactive about it. And I think that's a nice way to introduce, you know, the topic as far as writing goes. I think for me as an artist, I would do it a different way.
It's definitely good to hear your story too, because oftentimes we feel alone when we're experiencing these things. And it's just not something we often talk about as Native people. And I think it would help us to talk about it more, because maybe it would help alleviate some of that burden we're feeling from racism, and maybe help dialogue with white citizens of Farmington about what else we can do about the situation. But there was another situation that happened, again, that I talk a bit about in the preface of my book. A friend of mine went missing in 1998, and his name was Purnell Tewangotua. He was Navajo and Hopi, and he was a recent graduate of a cosmetology school. So he was scheduled to start work and disappeared after he went out with some friends. And I remember running into his sister at the Animas Valley Mall, and she was alone and putting up posters of her brother and talking to people that she knew, asking anyone if they've seen him. And I just remember thinking, why aren't the police involved? Why isn't the community involved? And that went on for years. And I followed his story over the years and hoped that he would be found someday. But I found out later that the police investigation was really discriminatory. They were saying that he was just another drunk Navajo. He probably went on a drinking spree and he'll return home. And his family ended up finding his car that he was driving that night burnt to its frame in Choctari Canyon. So obviously there was foul play. It's still, I think, a cold case. I think it's still open technically, but the handling of this case was what bothered me, was that if he was white, would this have happened? Would the case have been fumbled? Would people take it more seriously? So a number of these things, Purnell's disappearance, hearing stories about the Choctari massacre in the 1970s, then the later protests in the streets of Farmington, it just made sense to me to write about it. Actually, I started out being more of a creative writer. I was studying journalism at Fort Lewis and really loved it, but felt like, you know, there was another direction that I wanted to go as well. So actually my writing, it's funny because when you do academic books, you get all these reviewers that read it, critique it, and advise the press whether it should be published or not. And some of the reviewers criticized my writing style, saying that I wrote more like a journalist or had a journalistic style, but that's just kind of like my natural storytelling process. And I think that's something I like in my own writing. And even though I got all this criticism, I kept it in there because it was important for me to keep my voice.
Yeah, it is, you know, and I think, you know, I talk to a lot of Native artists on this program, and, you know, some are writers, some are painters, some are sculptors or jewelry makers, and they always talk about how story, and in Navajo, we call this hanet or bahanet, telling story, telling our history. Honestly, I think, Cheryl, it's very innate within us to be storytellers as Navajo people. You know, I can't speak for any other indigenous people here in the Americas because they have their own ways of believing, but as a Navajo woman born from a Navajo mother, I really do think that it's part of our DNA and it's a genetic code that's within our blood, you know, to be storytellers. But I was going to ask you before you go on, and thank you for sharing what you've shared so much as far as how you became inspired to write about issues of race and discrimination. Can you give us the title of your book and what the press is?
The book's called Our Fight Has Just Begun, Hate Crimes and Justice in Native America. It was published last year by the University of Arizona Press.
So it's been out for a little bit. Do you have plans to work on another book, or are you going to go in a different direction? What's your plans for the future of your writing?
So I always wanted to write more books. I think at the heart of my path to becoming a scholar, I was thinking back on this this past year when my book came out. There was a moment in Durango when I was going to Fort Lewis College. I was downtown at Maria's Bookshop, and I was looking at all the books. And I've always been a bookworm. I'm an avid reader. I read everything. I love books, fiction, nonfiction. And the Native American book section was sparse. And at the time, and this, granted, this was about 20 years ago, there were only a handful of books written by Native American authors. And just the usual kind of books, of course, like Simon Ortiz and Scott Momaday. But beyond that, there really wasn't much. And I remember that moment and thinking, there really needs to be more Native people writing about Native issues, whether it be law and policy, whether it be fiction, poetry, anything, you know, because at the time, and maybe it's still this in this situation now, but the field was dominated by white scholars primarily. And so when I got a few notices over the past few years of if my book was at a bookstore or something, it was just a moment of coming full circle when I saw that Maria's Bookstore was carrying my book. I was just like, this is kind of a good moment Native writers should experience. You know, I think the more Navajo scholarship we have out there, the stronger we are. And unfortunately, I wasn't aware of his work at the time, but John Redhart House has his work and his scholarship is just truly incredible. And I think growing up in the Four Corners, if I would have had his book or his manuscript at that time, I think I wouldn't have felt so alone in experiencing racism and discrimination, because he's written large amounts on that. I think oftentimes growing up in the Four Corners, at least this is my experience, I can't speak for anybody else, I wasn't really aware that there were protests in downtown Farmington. If I knew that growing up as a young Navajo person in Farmington or near Farmington, I just think I would have just had such a sense of pride. Like, there was a moment in history where people stood up for themselves and said, we're not going to take this anymore, you know?
Yeah, you know, and it's good that you're looking to our past leaders. You mentioned John Redhouse. Other ones are also like the late Larry Emerson, you know, who kind of led the way for our generation. And then now it's like Cheryl, you and I are the older sisters or the aunties to the new generation of Native Navajo students within our communities who, you know, are looking for people who look like them and write like them and tell story like them in the bookshelves of, let's say, Maria's Bookshop, you know. And what's really cool about, you know, you finding your book title at Maria's Bookshop in Durango is that, you know, Durango is a college town. So, you know, I kind of feel like they're a little bit more open-minded to talking about issues of cultural society's ills, you know, the social ills, such as, you know, racism and discrimination, where, you know, this town here, Tota, is not so open to that, you know. And I think that's one of the things that has stymied us as Navajos. You know, we know Farmington is a place of commerce, and it's always been a mecca for Native people who are indigenous to this place. The Navajos, the Utes, the Pueblos, the Apaches, you know, we always came to this place of water, which is what means Tota, to bring our cattle, bring our tired, weary bodies to come to the water and plant our crops, you know. So it always has been a place of gathering. I think what's really nice about your book is that you're sort of, in a way, symbolically gathering people back to this place to relearn the real history of what this place is as a place called Farmington. But to us as Navajos, it's known as Tuktot. What I was going to ask you next, Cheryl, is, you know, in your book, you have a lot of photographs. And I know a lot of the photographs, you have images of what you spoke about earlier in the 1970s, the protests that happened. Can you tell us a little bit more, maybe visually, about some of the photographs that you have in your book and why you have those in your book?
I came across this online collection of photographs by Bob Fitch. It's located at Stanford. Most of it's up online. I was unaware of this collection before, and they're just breathtaking. I wish I could have had colored photos inside the book, but if anyone's interested, you can just do a search for Farmington Collection, Bob Fitch Photography, Stanford. It comes up and you can see the beautiful colored images online. One of my favorites is of this Navajo woman. I never found out who she was, so if anybody finds out, please let me know. But she's holding a child and she has a protest sign. And her sign says, "Our fight has just begun." And it was important for me to use these images because I was just so proud when I saw them all. I was impressed. I remember hearing vaguely family members telling me about the protests, but I think the saying's correct, a picture's worth a thousand words. And just seeing thousands of Navajos walk through the streets of Farmington, you know, in the downtown Farmington, it's awe-inspiring. Another favorite of mine is a group of our Diné matriarchs leading part of the protest. I think it's just so symbolic of how I grew up with a strong Navajo grandmother, strong mother, and they were right there leading protests. Some other images are from some of that police violence against the demonstrators. There was a standoff by the end of the protest. They protested for, I think it was 6 consecutive Saturdays in the summer of 1974. And Bob Fitt was traveling through Farmington during that time and captured some of the police violence against Navajos. And there's another one from the Daily Times that captures one of the protesters throwing back a canister at the police. So all these stories, and I feel like I wish there could have been so much more in the book. I wish I would have had time to do more. You know, there was just enough time for me to cover like the biggest issues of each one. But each of these chapters could have easily been a book. I hope that the coalition of Navajo liberation members or elders, the ones that are still with us, I wish they would put together a book of their own story. I think it would have, again, as a young person growing up in Farmington, it would have meant so much to see that, to see something from them about their experiences. And not just that other book, you know, written by Rodney Barker. I think some of that was really not done in good taste, you know. So again, I'm always an advocate of us as Diné, as Indigenous people, telling our own stories. You know, we don't need white scholars, white authors to tell these stories for us. We're perfectly capable. Our history is beautiful. We've come from thousands of years of oral story tradition. And I think that's just something we should do. And I would recommend younger people to do too, is take that up, keep writing, keep producing, and don't be afraid to tell our own story.
Yes, I believe that too, Cheryl. I wanted to mention that the Bob Fitch Photograph Collection, it is available now in the San Juan College Library's catalog. A couple years ago, one of the librarians here put it available for students to use as part of their studies and research. And one of the things that they also did was they put some of those photographs on display, public display here at the college. And I will say that I got to see them and they were very powerful. They were in black and white, but the imagery was so wonderful because it told such great narrative visually. And I really applaud Bob Fitch, you know, for having those photographs taken that he did. I will mention that, you know, those photographs were vandalized as they were on display here at the college. People were writing on them, and, you know, and it wasn't in a good way. It wasn't meant to be anything good from it. It was really terrible what the things they were doing to those photographs. So eventually I think that librarian had to take them down, which is problematic. And it tells a lot about the state of our current climate here in Farmington. You know, people have grown to see it and become apathetic to what's going on here. And, you know, I think that's problematic. You know, for me as a artist visually, I try to combat that with my art. And I feel like you're doing the same with your writing. Even though, Cheryl, you're not dwelling within this space now, you've lived it in your experience growing up here. And then being now in South Arizona at the university there, you know, you're able to carry on the story beyond the borders of the United States, you know, because I'm sure you dialogue with other scholars around the world about similar issues that parallel Indigenous people From your writing and from your book, since it's been published, Cheryl, where have you had opportunities to kind of talk about such issues or maybe find some kind of community with other Indigenous people in the United States, in the world, Canada? Can you talk a little bit about maybe some of those experiences and how it's helped you, you know, in your writing or inspirations?
Unfortunately, there aren't a whole lot of scholars here in the United States who study hate crimes or criminal issues against Indigenous populations. So I was fortunate during the past few years to collaborate with a number of scholars all over the world on this compilation called Decolonizing Criminology. And I wrote a piece in there about anti-violence, what can Native communities do to combat violence in their own communities. And I do mention my work on and scholarship on hate crimes in Farmington and other border towns. And it was just neat to be part of that dialogue, even though I didn't have a whole lot of interaction with some of the other authors, but just knowing that there were other Indigenous people out there that were working on criminal issues or different type of issues. Also, during the past few years, I was in touch with a group that advocates for against hate crimes committed against Indigenous populations in and around Europe. So that's also interesting to note that, you know, some of our experiences with discrimination and hate crimes are happening all over the world. And I think you asked the question, I don't remember if I answered it in full, about my next steps for scholarship or work. I've always wanted to do a book that explores this issue nationally. And I think there was just so much information that I wanted to include, and our fight has just begun. But I realized that I had more than enough information about our Diné experience with this, that it would just have to wait for another project. And so definitely I have plans to just keep working on this issue because I feel like it's important. It's something that I still deal with, you know, every time my mom's living in the Four Corners still. So every time I come visit my mom, you know, I'm still mindful of these things. And I'm not surprised at all what you're telling me about what happened at San Juan College Library. I feel like there's still this unhealed, and maybe it will never heal, this unhealed pain about what happened during the Choctari massacre. And it wasn't, the acts of violence were bad enough, but what I explored in my book didn't focus on those atrocious acts, but focused on what was the community's response. And unfortunately, the community's response in Farmington was to deny what happened, to say that it wasn't as horrible as it really was, and then to vilify our now elder protesters and say that they were troublemakers or stirring up trouble or that sort of nonsense. You know, all these things are still present. So it was important to me to include current information in the book too. So I discuss at the end of the book, you know, some issues that were happening in other places such as Page. You know, there was some discrimination and racism happening surrounding the COVID-19 pandemic. But I think that the more that we talk about these things, and at least come up with some way we're going to combat it or dialogue with Farmington about what they can do and they haven't done, you know, is implement educational strategies in school. And I think it's just not making things any better to keep the secret of racism and discrimination in Farmington.
I agree. Well, gosh, you know, I mean, I could talk to you for hours and hours on this subject. And, you know, it is one of those things that people don't want to dialogue about it. You know, they want to look over it. You know, what is that phrase that says seen and not heard, or I can't remember how it goes. But I think just the fact that, you know, you're still writing about it no matter what is very needed. And you know, just being a voice there within a greater educational area is a good thing to have an ally for Native people and Navajo people in border town communities. So I really, really appreciate what you're doing, Cheryl. And I wish you many blessings and, you know, more research to come. And I really thank you for coming and talking to me today about writing and, you know, writing on different subject matters, you know, because you are still a part of the Four Corners. So maybe I'll catch up with you again somewhere down the road and we can talk about your next book. I just wish you a great autumn season, and we'll talk to you soon. And where are the places that people can purchase your book?
Currently, the book is available on the University of Arizona Press website. It's also available from the usual retailers such as Amazon. Unfortunately, I don't know if it's available in Farmington. So it's definitely available online, though. So if you just do a search for it, Our Fight Has Just Begun, and by Cheryl Redhorse Bennett, it will be available. And thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed our dialogue.
Yes, yeah, thank you too. Thank you for listening to Native Art Voices. And till next time, we will see you again. Hagoana.
Did you enjoy that podcast? We hope that you did. And if you did, share it with your friends. And if you really want to keep podcasts like this coming, please support KSJE. You can do it easily online at ksje.com.